On Thursday, I had the pleasure of seeing my friend Andy Bothwell, a.k.a. Astronautilus, perform here in Oakland. And I know he's my friend, and I know I'm biased, but he killed it. He was so good, and I was so proud of him. And don't take my word for it. I walked over to talk to him at the merch table afterwards, and we were just shooting the shit, reminiscing about old times, and the bartender comes up to him. And the bartender said, "Hey, man, I see a ton of shows. I see a lot of people. You were great. You're such a good performer. Do you have a CD I could buy?" And Andy was so touched and handed him a CD. He said, "Don't worry about it. Just thank you so much for the compliment." And we talked about it afterwards. And he said, that for me is one of the greatest compliments I can get as a musician. You know, these guys have seen everything. And if I can touch them, I know I'm doing something right. And that whole experience got me thinking about how I'm not someone who is really inspired by celebrities, by politicians, by people of that nature. The people that inspire me are my friends, are my family. And it's moments like that, seeing a friend of mine just really get the accolades he deserved and put in just such hard work to get there. That's what inspires me. And so I wanted to bring some of these stories to our podcast. And I wanted to start with someone I'm extremely proud of and who works harder than almost anyone I know. And that's my sister, Elaine. She's a social worker in New Orleans. And her stories, her days are so different than what I deal with on a daily basis. And they, hearing her struggles grounds me. It gives me inspiration to move forward, and it helps me keep perspective. And with this podcast, I ask her to tell a very personal story about an experience that just happened to her. And I think you'll be really touched by it, and I'm just really proud of her. I can't stress that enough, and the work she's doing is really tremendous. So tell me specifically your job description, because I'm always going to get it wrong.
Yeah, and that's okay, because it is a little complicated. So I'm a social worker with NAMI New Orleans. NAMI stands for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and it is a national organization. And so I work for the New Orleans branch, and I'm the case management coordinator for the intensive case management unit. So there are different units within NAMI that are posed to help various individuals, and our main focus is helping individuals that are struggling with a mental illness. So kind of what I do is I have 10 clients that I see on a regular basis that have been diagnosed with a severe mental illness. A lot of times they're coexisting with other mental illnesses, so it could be major depression, sure, and PTSD, or a lot of times they're coexisting with substance abuse issues. So that's kind of the main crux of who I see. And I also, what I do, I don't see them in an office, I do community work. So I go to where they are.
And well, sometimes kind of the crazy part to me, and that's what I always want to get across to other people when they ask me what you do. Is I think that intimate involvement you have with the people you work with is it's unusual and extra challenging.
It is. It definitely is. You know, the reality is I'm not always going into places or situations that are, you know, I'm not in uptown New Orleans. I'm in some different areas that you don't necessarily walk into feeling like, oh, this is the place I want to spend the afternoon. But a lot of my clients are formerly homeless or homeless.
Sure.
So a lot of them are living on Section 8 vouchers. Sometimes they're living with family, and sometimes they don't have a home at all. So sometimes I'm meeting them at a park or at a McDonald's or somewhere that's safe for them, that they feel comfortable. And the other part is it is an intimate thing. It's in my experience, you see them living in their daily lives, day to day, good, bad, ugly. I mean, when you're in somebody's home, I mean, that's a truly intimate setting. And what it's created for me, it's a lot of education, as well as, to me, it's kind of an honor when you're invited in somebody's home and when you build this rapport with a client and they're comfortable enough to say, hey, sit down on the couch, do you want something to drink? And, And you tend to get closer, in my opinion, to some of your clients.
They're even in your car. Like, you have to drive mm-hmm. them to their appointments.
Yes. Because sometimes, depending on their mental health status, or sometimes, you know, physically, they can't get to some of their appointments. And it's important that we make sure they do see the psychiatrist and get their medications, et cetera, et cetera. So when you're driving with somebody side by side, and sometimes you're stuck in traffic or traveling a fair distance, you know, things like that. When you're sitting side by side with someone in a car, those are when the conversations really open up. And that's when I really start to know about the intimate lives of my clients. Because, you know, I can do an intake and I can chat with them, but when somebody's comfortable with you, that really creates the rapport and the relationships.
Well, and that's where I kind of wanted to pick up, because that's the story that you've basically lived recently, where you were having a tough time in your life and taking a client to an appointment and really were able to almost rely on them for counseling. And for this story, we can just call your patient Bob. So we don't have to use names.
Bob. Yeah,
just to protect anonymity. But pick up there about, give some background, because that was my impetus for this whole call, because I found this story really personal and touching, and give me some background about him and sort of this encounter.
Sure. Okay. Bob was one of my first clients. I started at NAMI in August, and he was one of my first clients, and he's from Arkansas. And so we immediately had a connection there because, you know, our dad's from Arkansas. So, you know, we were laughing about that, and we just hit it off. He was a good guy, real funny, really sweet, and struggling with major depression and substance abuse issues. He was housed before I had him on a Hano Section 8 voucher. So he lived in a little apartment, was very, you know, meager, that kind of thing. And what I would do with him is I would go to his home, and sometimes we do some counseling. He had a tough life. His entire family was still in Arkansas. He recently lost his father. Like I said, he was really struggling with some mental health issues.
Right.
We also do things like get him to different appointments. I'd help schedule things for him. He couldn't really ever remember things, so I was always going over there to remind him about appointments and helping him get there. And he had been struggling with some health issues. So I was able to find, he didn't have insurance, so I was able to find a place on the West Bank that would take him without insurance. Great little community health clinic, just wonderful people there. So he struggled with some different things. So I got him there, and we've been going to these appointments and being able to, you know, kind of get his health on track, which was a good thing. I was feeling really hopeful for him because it felt like, okay, he's taking his medication for mental health. He was really opening up, and he was definitely feeling a little lighter in the last couple months, you know, just able to get out more, socializing more.
Right.
And also, I'd also built a relationship with his sister. In order to talk with any family, friends, anything about our clients, we have to have a signed release of information. So, like, if somebody were to call me and say, hey, I need to ask you about my brother or my sister, I can't tell them anything, even that I even see them.
That makes sense.
So, yeah, it makes sense because it is protecting your client confidentiality. You don't know the relationships of that, you know, but we were able to get that signed release of information. So between her and myself, we were able to kind of really get Bob on track. And so recently I was just going through some personal things, you know, terrible boys and typical 32-year-old single woman stuff, right? And I mean,
right.
Let's be real. You know, getting broken up with an email is never fun, even if you're a healthy social worker, right? And I mean, as cool as I am, things can still hurt. So, and honestly, you know, what I do, you know, you don't do it for thanks. I'm no Mother Teresa. You know, I do what I do because I love it. I love being a social worker, and I believe in what we do. And we also still have really hard days where our clients are not grateful. They're angry at us because we, quote unquote, don't do anything for them, because systems are hard inevitably, and I can't control Medicaid. I can't control housing all the time. So you don't get a lot of thanks, or sometimes you're criticized a lot, and you run into walls feeling like, wow, is anything that I'm doing ever going to work for somebody? Am I really ever going to be able to help this person sometimes?
Right.
And with him, he was the kind of client, he would just always thank me. He was always grateful. He always just said, I so look forward to seeing you. And that really, that motivated me, you know. And
oh, absolutely.
So Yeah, because he just made me, and he was always so fun. He would never hit on me, but he would say, "You're so pretty. You're such a dandy." He would say just really sweet things like that. But I mean, believe it or not, yes, a formerly homeless, you know, individual. Yes, he did make my day. It doesn't matter who it is. I mean, a compliment is really nice. Okay, so this one particular day, we were getting into the doctor and. Get to my car and we're driving and kind of in a mood, you know, getting this email and having some personal stuff.
Right.
And, but seeing him, you know, did kind of lighten my day a little bit. So we're sitting there waiting, you know, it's a long wait to the doctor's office. And he looks at me in his very thick accent and everything. Are you okay? How's your day going? And I just kind of look at him. I'm like, I'm okay. You know, I'm okay. And a lot of times with my clients, as opposed to being this therapist sitting across the desk, you know, a lot of times we're taught, and I think it's important that we keep our personal stuff personal. And
right.
because you're so intimate with these clients in the sense that you're sitting in their home and you're hanging out, this kind of stuff, there's a little less guard there, to be honest. And so I said, you know, I'm okay. You know, I'm not having the best day. You know, I'm pretty honest, but I wasn't going to divulge too much. But he said, well, I know you have really hard days. And I just, you know, I really appreciate what you do. And you know, you're just great. You're just great. No, thanks. You know, and it really kind of put a pep in my step, and we laugh. Yeah, it was really cute. We'd always laugh and stuff, and, you know, so then we were in the car driving home after his appointment, and he's like, why aren't you married? You know, I get that a lot. You know, being in the South, I get this all the time, and I guess because I'm 32, single, whatever, you know, it's like, why don't you have kids and married? And, I mean, my answer is, well, no one's asked, any of all, so, you know, so come on. So you know, I joke with him saying that, and he's like, well, someone should, because you are just a dandy. You are just great. I'm like, oh, thanks, you know, thank you. So we're just laughing. And so that following week, so that was, I think, on a Wednesday. The following week, on a Monday, his sister called me and said, you know, I'm very worried about Bob. My birthday was yesterday, and he always calls me on my birthday, even if his phone has run out of minutes. So a lot, like most of my clients have government phones. They only have a set number of minutes for each month, and they run out a lot. So, and he would often not call or kind of go MIA for a few days. So that was kind of one of his MOs sometimes. And so I wasn't terribly worried, but I did think it was a little strange. So I called him twice on Monday, and he always calls me back, I would say, within like 24 to 48 hours. Because, like I said, he's not somebody that looks at the phone all the time. He's not us on our iPhones all the time, right? And the next morning, I had to get up and go do an intake. When we get a new client, I do intakes with all of our new clients. So I just kind of had a feeling. I said, you know what, I'm just going to drive over there, because I'd called him again Tuesday morning. And I was in the East, had to drive over to the West Bank, and I go knock on the door, call his phone. I even went by to where he hangs out with some of his friends on a corner and asked if they'd seen him, and I left a note on his door. And by this time, you know, I kind of taken a lot of time out of my day to go do that. So I went back to the office to pack something for a client that needed to be in before noon. I called the sister. I said, okay, I'm kind of worried now too. We need to have the apartment complex go and check. So she said, okay, I'm going to do that. And let's, you know, I'll call you back. I said, okay. Like I said, I'd left a note on his door. So at this time, I'm actually getting ready to get back in my car and go over there again so I can go talk to the apartment people and go with them if needed and make a phone call. And it's the apartment complex leasing agents. And they said, hi, you know, is this Elaine? And, you know, you're Mr. Bob's social worker. And I said, yeah, well, honey, he's dead.
Just like that.
Yeah. It was very, it was just very factual. I think... Too, kind of in their line of business, this isn't the first time this has happened. Not that it gives it any, you know, relief, but
that's such a shocking. I mean, there was no, I have some bad news. It was just straight up. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. It was just straight up, well, he's dead. And I was sitting in my office, you know, my bag, I would carry this big bag with all my stuff in it, you know, and I just stopped and my hands on my cricket just started shaking. And it just kind of, it quite literally felt like a punch in the stomach. The wind was knocked out of me. And I just stood there and I just said, okay, I'm on my way. I'm on my way. It's all I could really get out of my mouth. And one of my coworkers, you know, we all kind of have our work wives, our work husbands, who's like your closest kind of coworker, you know, so came, he says, well, I'm going with you. You're shaking. You know, this is it. You're overwhelmed. And I said, yeah, you know, I would love the support. You know, that's what you do when somebody is going through things. Yeah, that's what you do. Teamwork. Teamwork makes the dream work. So we get in the car, and at that time, his sister calls. And I pick up the phone thinking, I don't know if I'm going to have to tell her or what's going on.
Right.
And it's just these sobs and screeching. And the words aren't even there. It's just, you know, he's gone, he's gone, and she's just screeching. And I'm trying to say, I'm on my way, and I'm so sorry. I mean, you know, what do you say? And you're over a phone, so it's not even very intimate.
Right.
You wish you could hug that person. And yeah.
And so, she had found out from the apartment complex, I'm assuming.
Well, actually, the apartment complex immediately called EMS and the police, and they were right there. And so the police showed up right away and called her.
Ah, I see.
So this all happened around the same kind of time as we're getting out the door, because it takes a little bit to get over to the West Bank with traffic and stuff. So I'm thinking, it was a very, when I saw her phone, you know, her name come up on my phone, I'm thinking, oh my God, am I going to have to tell her? And there was a piece of me that was slightly relieved that she already knew, because I didn't know how I would hold it together if I had to deliver that kind of news. So all I could tell her was, like, I'm going to be with them right now. I'm going there. Because there was this thought in my head of thinking, if this was somebody I loved, I wouldn't want them to be alone. I mean, the apartment complex, people didn't know him. He's dead. You know, I cared about him. I knew him. And there was just something in me that wanted to go. And you know, honestly, technically, all we really have to do is file this report and just kind of follow up. And that's just not intimate enough or enough for me. So I went, and we get to the apartment complex, and I see, you know, there's a EMS and things are there, so they have to check. And I go to the apartment, and the door's open, and I don't really know. I've never had this situation happen before. I walk in, and he's there. The body's still there as it was. And that was very shocking for me. It was very
jarring. I can't imagine.
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was very, very hard for that to happen. And they're like, yeah, you know, this is him, right? I'm like, yeah, yes, yes, yes. And, you know, and I'm standing there just sort of shaking and stunned. Is this really what I'm witnessing from him? It felt like a dream a little bit. So the EMS does check. He's, in fact, deceased. And that was hard. So I stayed, and I spoke with the coroner and all of that. I gave all the information, and I stayed late until they took him, because I just, as I said, like, I felt like I wanted to be there.
Yeah.
And it just felt that was what I did out of respect. And I'm not saying, you know, like, going over above and beyond for every single person. I just knew it was the right thing to do. I'm glad I did it.
Yeah.
Of course, I continued to talk with his sister, and then I went to his apartment the following week to grab some things to mail to his family.
And there wasn't much.
I had to.
From what?
No,
you...
and that's, yeah, when I went back, that was also a very surreal experience, walking back into his apartment. They hadn't changed anything. And there's this hat that I actually, our parents, you know, Mom and Pop had done a spring cleaning not that long ago. And so for the winter, they sent me a bunch of stuff that maybe my clients, you know, might enjoy. You know, some long shirts and some jackets and some stuff and some hats. And of course, Pop had a John Deere hat. And so I'd given that to him. And I'd also given him, you know, Pop's, you know, very, you know, slight. And so was Bob. He's, you know, kind of a slight gentleman. So I gave him all these Armani and Prada buttons on shirts. And he would come to the door wearing, you know, this John Deere hat and these Armani, you know, Jim Looney shirts, you know, those little messages. I was just like, oh, God, it's so precious. You know, it just made me so happy. He loved them. He always felt really good in them, you know.
That's great.
And, yeah, it was pretty funny. So I saw those shirts when I was in there and just thought, oh, man, you know, that was hard. But so I got some things, you know, for family and talking to the sister. You know, I told her, I just said, you know, I'll tell you, I told her the story about me having a bad day. I didn't go to, you know, any of the boy details, but I definitely told her, you know, I was having a bad day and your brother made it better.
Wow.
And yeah, I think that meant a lot to her. So we've continued to have a bit of a relationship, you know, calling here and there. I had to write a letter for his son's boss to let him off work for bereavement. And, yeah, so it's one of those things that technically, yeah, you just have to file a report and do that kind of stuff, but it doesn't stop there. And to be honest, the work that I do, there is a mortality rate.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reality of it. And I go to LCSW supervision, which for those people that may not understand that, basically to become an LCSW, licensed clinical social worker, we basically have like work therapy every week for about 3 years. And so I had to go, I did an emergency supervision session with my supervisor, and he, you know, it was very comforting. We talked a lot about that. And he, since I started working at NAMI, he made me very aware that I'm going to have clients that die.
Right.
And of course he said it in a, you know, let's really process this because it's going to be a hard reality. And in fact it was. And I have clients that maybe I've expected this for them, but this was a shock. It's going to be a shock no matter what. And it wasn't suicide. It was natural causes. So I didn't see it coming, and it has had a profound effect on me.
Well, and it's one thing when you expect this may happen, but another thing when you form a bit of a relationship with these people, like you had with Bob.
Exactly. And, you know, you have your clients that are very, very heavily involved with drugs and not taking their medications and having very poor, you know, self-care. And you're thinking, okay, this is somebody I might need to kind of put in the back of my head, you know, prepare yourself. And I knew he had his health issues and everything. But we were really keeping him on track, you know, and mm-hmm. because I think you do form closer relationships, you're not going to think he can die. Cause I didn't want to think that about him. I wanted him to be my client for a long time.
Yeah. You wanted him to succeed.
And I felt like he really was and could, you know? And so, yeah, that was hard. You're right. I mean, having that relationship, it's hard. And like I said, what we do when you're in the mental health field, there's a certain rate. I mean, actually, if someone's diagnosed with major depression, 15% of those people will die via suicide. So you have this awareness.
15%?
15, yes.
That's still pretty high.
It is high, if you think about it. I mean, that's 15% of, let's say, you have a handful of clients or, you know, diagnosed with that. I mean, you have to have this awareness that might happen. You know, and I think about the impact he's going to make on my career and how I walk forward as a social worker in the city of New Orleans for forever. And I'm going to make sure it's a good impact. And I'm going to make sure it's an awareness that I'll always have. And maybe one day when I'm teaching other social workers or supervising other social workers, I'm able to, you know, recount the tales of, you know, why it's important to have good relationships with these people, because I was there for a sister. I was able to tell her some stories. I was able to go through the apartment and find the things. And I thought, yeah, but he really loves these things. Like I grabbed the John Deere hat for his son and things mm-hmm. like that.
And my impetus for kind of wanting to do this and put it out there is there's a bit too of his story and your story vice versa helps. It helps me. It helps other people because I think it gains perspective in the world. It's easy for me to be all consumed about designing a logo that a client didn't like or a piece of packaging that didn't go well. But there's a bit that's a nice reality check in this to know that there are a lot more difficult situations in the world. And I'm not to say that people can't have a bad day. If you're whatever your profession
right.
is, that clients can be difficult, work can be difficult, but there's still a bit of perspective that I think can be gained from this. That was sort of that's what I take away from this. And that's what mm-hmm. I kind of wanted to also put forward.
Yeah, and I think that's really great. A friend of mine told me a story. She was actually dealing with the death of her father, and she's a lawyer, and she was trying to get out some contracts. And a coworker said, "That's just some paper. Go do you. You know, I mean, take care of yourself." And I think about that old story, and then having this experience because it is humanity, and I think human beings, you know, we're not. We are meant to be in relationships. it's all about being attached to other human beings. We simply can't survive or be happy without relationships. And I think that is something that we can lose very easily. Now, if I had to design a logo, that would be a very, very bad day for me. I would not succeed at that, right? I mean, that sounds like a terrible day for me because, you know, it looked like a kid did a crayon drawing. But so everybody has their own struggles and their own, you know, bad days. But this does, I think, I hope it will give it, sharing grief can always, you know, make it something that it's not as sad sometimes. If something comes out of it that is worthwhile, you know, and
well, it is, and
help
it's
somebody else.
I think we tend to want to find heroes in celebrities and things of that nature, very vapid sources. But for me, what's very grounding is hearing your story and finding heroes in people like you. And you are the people I admire, the person I admire.
Oh, thanks.
And that's,
thank you. Well,
that's what I think is really powerful. And that's what I would like people to also keep in the back of their mind.
Well, that's nice. Thank you. I mean, you know, I don't feel like a hero. I was lucky enough to have a person that made an impact on my life, you know, in a lot of ways. And, you know, and it's interesting too, the day that I had, that we had the appointment and he cheered me up after, you know, the breakup and everything. I went out with a friend that night and he's actually thinking about going into social work school. And I said, you know, I know I'm having a bad day, a bad week, but man, you get to do my job, do a job like mine, and you get to have clients like Bob. And that's totally worth it. And that's why you should be a social worker, because you get to have days like this. And then a week later, you know, he's no longer here, and it's very, very sad. But I still get to have days with other people like that. And to me, I just feel lucky. And the small successes that we get to have in this very, very broken world, which I see daily, you know, and hourly, they're pretty big. They feel really good, you know. If it's just making sure my client stays in a house or is sober for a whole day, that feels good. Because it's all about humanity.
Well, and I think keeping the perspective, it's so easy just to get bogged down in all the injustice in the world, all the problems. I was reading an article about why Jon Stewart decided to step down, because I was shocked when I heard that.
And, same here, I'm sad.
Well, and it's almost his description was his outrage at the political system and so on and so forth, and that he just felt like he was saying the same thing over and over, and change wasn't happening, and it was just wearing him down. And I thought that is so sad.
Yeah, that is sad. And there is such thing that's called, you know, compassion fatigue that sometimes you can experience, which is you just run out. And that's why I think it's important to keep a perspective of, I can't necessarily change the entire world right now.
Right.
But I can do the next right thing, and I can be kind to somebody. I can go a little bit out of my comfort zone to help somebody, to do a little something extra. Because I think it's sometimes in those little things, it's what helps. And to be honest, you know, I'll tell people I'm a social worker and think, oh man, I want to do great things for humanity like you. And I'm like, no, I'm just trying to help do what I can, you know, do what I can because I love what I do. But also, if you think that way, then yeah, go and volunteer on a weekend. Go and get some perspective. Be nice to the checkout people. You know, they might be having a bad day too.
Yeah,
be nice
exactly.
to the telemarketer because they have a crappy job.
Yeah, it's the little things and it's a cumulative effect. It's not this one magnanimous gesture. Rarely can we achieve that. It's just sort of being mindful and present in the day to day and with those interactions that we have.
Exactly. And also through that experience, you know, I really had to teach myself that self-care is truly self-care. You really have to take it on yourself. And, you know, but I also, you know, I talked to you and of course, Darrow is supportive, Mom, Pop, all of my friends. I had a great supervisor to help me through it. And I saw the humanity of the people that love me reaching out and really caring about the experience I was going through. So it kind of came full circle of this reaching out and let's put down our pens and paper and our iPhones and let's reach out and talk about what's hard and what's important about relationships. I just think we can get, like you said, so bogged down in the woulda, coulda, shouldas and the things we can't accomplish, I wonder if we should maybe focus on the little things that we can.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
That was my talk with Elaine. What did you think?
That was wonderful. I really, Butler, I had tears in my eyes listening to it.
It's a powerful story.
It is very powerful. You know, I'm so proud of both you and Elaine. Y'all are so different, yet y'all are so alike in that you are so relationship-oriented, and you value relationships, you nurture relationships, and you see how much you learn and grow from relationships. When I was listening to it, I kept remembering the quote from To Kill a Mockingbird, when Atticus Finch says to Scout, his daughter, "You never know someone until you walk in their shoes."
And I think that's what I wanted people to be able to just take that small piece from Elaine's experience and put it in their own lives.
And take time to walk in someone else's shoes and take time to listen to people. I think the biggest mistake we make is not to listen to people, but to be thinking about what we're going to say when they finish talking. And I heard that, and I was reminded that grief shared is halved, and joy shared is doubled, and to take time to do that. Sometimes I think we forget that, you know, we're here in the world to make another person's life better. And I think you and Elaine both do it. I am a proud mama.
Well, thank you.
Sitting on a futon mat in a squad in Darmstadt, Kevin's second said to me in passing, "Oh, age never meant shit to me. It's all about heart and stupidity. Thought that there's no better way to live." We were on the steps in Borno, and she bit my lip and choked my throat. A highball glass shattered above our heads. It seemed her lover listened through the walls while we were kissing arm in arm. Left and spent the night alone instead. I couldn't tell you, dear, which one whispers in my ear, devil or St. Andrew, but I know it's time to go. Sure, you got a great theory, from hunting something or it's haunting me. No, there ain't no right way to measure the glow. Oh no. Oh no. I know what you dream of, a dream of it too. Roads that are endless, rooms that are huge. These visions of heaven or nightmares I'm living, all I know is I'm scared of the truth. And if the world could end very soon, then all we've accomplished is move. Coat the carpet in gasoline, strike our last match, and before the whole house is consumed. So I cover my hand in tattoos, I'll kiss any woman that moves. There's no Lord to forgive me, and physics is tricky, so all that I'm left with is you. It's all that I'm left with is you. It's all that I'm left with is you. I couldn't tell you, dear, which one whispers in my ear, devil or St. Andrew, but I know it's time to go. Sure, you got a great theory, from hunting something or it's hunting me.